Blog Talk Radio.
Guys, you know what time it is? It is Tuesday night, and that means it is B2B podcast night. Welcome in. I'm your host, Dr. Marcy, America's Voice for the Voiceless, and we are in our final week of celebrating Black Business Month, and I'm super excited for tonight's guest because she has an amazing entrepreneurial story to share. So all this month, all of the guests have been Black business owners and entrepreneurs. And the conversations and the lessons that we can learn and the nuggets that they've shared have all been absolutely magnificent. I love being able to see the different ways that entrepreneurs are using their skills and their stories and struggles to really create amazing businesses, both in the profit and nonprofit sectors. So each week when we come together, those of you who follow the show know we have a healthy adult dialogue about a variety of critical life topics in hopes of providing some food for thought for you. And in turn, maybe, just maybe, you might be inspired to take action. That's always the hope. So my intention for the show every single week is for you to be able to hear something that will either move you, motivate you, or challenge you to make some proactive and sustainable changes in your own life and relationships, and in this case, also your businesses. So I always say that change can't happen around you until it occurs within you, and change starts with you. So before each show, I always ask that God use the show to have the conversations that need to be heard. I thank him for the voice, the platform, and the opportunity to become a conduit for healing and recovery. And just as a reminder, we are live tonight here on Blog Talk Radio. So if you would like to call in and either ask a question of tonight's guest or share your own story, we definitely welcome you. That number is 914-219-0880. And the phone lines will be open for the duration of the show. And again, that number is 914-219-0880. And I'll try to remember to repeat it again later on in the show, but I'm usually not very good at that part because I get so engrossed in what we're talking about with the guest. So tonight's conversation, again, another amazing woman, another amazing entrepreneur. She has a powerful story, a powerful testimony, and she is a game changer in her industry. And she's not only been able to crush it in one industry, but now, you know, navigating different areas of business. And so tonight's guest is Ms. Sabrina Fisher-Reese, who is a native of Compton, California, and she's a proud mother of four. She's the owner of the famous Braids by Sabrina. I cannot talk tonight, y'all. So let me try that again. The famous Braids by Sabrina. Girl, okay, let's try this one more time. Braids by Sabrina, Braiding and Dreadlock Studio. There we go. And she's had that business now for 26 years. So that's two decades, y'all, in L.A. So definitely has she got some information to share for sure. Her salon's employed over 1,700 African-American women in her community, and she's received numerous awards for her contribution to the city of Los Angeles as a business owner. And she also began her public her motivational speaking journey in 2015 after she realized that her own testimony of healing from past trauma could save the lives of other people. She's also an accomplished author of two life-changing self-help books. One is called My Spiritual Smile, and the other one is called Your Mind is Magic. And during her journey of personal development, she also created the hashtag In59Seconds movement with the intent to prove that no matter how busy you are, we all have a minimum of 59 seconds to be able to uplift, motivate, and encourage ourselves and others. It's our mission to raise the vibration of the entire nation and to teach people the importance of being kind and uplifting to others. And I absolutely love that mission. Sabrina, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I am, you know, I was thinking about, you know, who would be good guests? Who would be good guests for Black Business Month? And I remember I met you several years ago, I think at one of Dr. Will Moreland's events. I think it was at a Give Me the Mic. You had come here to Phoenix. And I remember you sharing little bits of your story then. And I was like, man, like this sister is powerful. So I am excited that I was able to get you to be able to invest some of your time and your willingness to share your story about how you've been able to really, I mean, 26 years in a market like LA in the hair industry, like that's crushing it. So, but I know you also have a really powerful personal testimony. So I'm going to stop talking since I can't talk right anyway. And I'm going to turn the microphone over to you. So tell us about who you are, what you've been through, where you've been, and, like, how did you manage 2 decades in L.A. as an African-American business owner?
All right. Well, let me let you know, I do talk a lot. So if you know, you can stop me if you have a question in the middle. So I don't just keep going on and on. My name is Sabrina Fisher. I'm from Compton. I went to Centennial High School. I went to Willowbrook Junior High School. Everybody who's from Compton, I'm sure they're familiar with those schools. And I was raised by my grandmother, a wonderful woman. She was from Dallas, Texas. So I was raised with all those Texas morals and values in a simple, really simple life. You know, the typical go to church every Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, usher board, Sunday school, everything, you know, all those things we may have resented then, but we're so grateful for that type of foundation now. And my life was simple. It was just me and my sister. My grandmother's youngest son, whose name is Jesse Paul Fisher, was my father. So we were his only 2 children. So she took on an 11-month-old, and me, who was 3 months old, and at the time she had to be 69, 70, maybe 71 years old at the time.
Wow.
So she took us on. Yeah. My mother was an addict. That's why she had to take us. When I was 3 months old, my grandmother got me at 3 months, because when I was 3 months old, my mother, during one of her crack binges, she took me and put me into a suitcase and attempted to take my life. My grandmother got me, and at 3 months old, and she raised me from then on. Every now and then I would see my mother throughout those years. It was always some really embarrassing appearance she would make, like high on drugs. She would come by the house and suddenly want to be a mother, you know, stuff like that. But for the most part, I had a really, from 3 months to 17, I had a really nice life. It was a simple life. We weren't rich, but we were happy. My grandmother was a wonderful person. She taught us all the little things you teach kids when you're from Dallas, Texas, like how to cook chicken and dumplings and salmon croquettes.
Oh, yeah.
So everything was great until my high school year at Centennial. I was captain of the cheerleaders. You know, I look back on that now and I realize I had leadership qualities then, but I definitely didn't know. I was like, where did I get the courage to go out for a captain of the cheerleaders, you know? But I guess it was in me. You know, it must have been in me all along.
Well, anyway, it sounds like you were raised with a really strong foundation, like with a really strong woman who, I mean, I'm sure your grandmother probably exhibited a lot of those qualities and probably instilled that in you, I would imagine.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, now that if I wouldn't be reflecting back to my childhood, I would have said that I developed this person who I am today later in life. But clearly some of those characteristics existed inside of me then, you know, which is great. So around the 12th grade, right before my high school graduation, my grandmother, who I mentioned was a devout Christian. Now, my grandfather was there, too. My grandfather was not my biological grandfather. He was my grandmother's second husband who kind of brought her and her three children from Dallas, Texas, to have a better life in California. So we always knew, you know, there was nothing significant in the marriage or no abuse or anything. We really had a simple life. Now, he wasn't that engaging with us, but he wasn't abusive in any way, and I never saw him do anything to her. However, it was always kind of known by something she must have said to us growing up that he wasn't the great love of her life. He just was like the man, the second husband, who was like, look, we're going to go to California and have a better life. So he brought her, my father, my auntie, and my uncle to California. So by the time the 12th grade came, I had just got a boyfriend, and my boyfriend worked as a security guard. That'll be pertinent to the story a little bit later on. So my grandmother came to me. She taught us to pray, you know. So she came to me one day, and she said, Mac, his name was Mac. My grandfather's name was Mac. McClendon, actually. And she said, Mac said that he was going to kill me. Now, I'm 17 years old, and I'm just kind of in my room, you know, probably waiting on my boyfriend to come by, something simple. We had a really simple, quiet life. So she comes into my room, and she says, Mac said he was going to kill me. So being the person that I was raised to pray, I said, Mama, well, you know, you should, do you know where his gun is? Because somehow throughout the years, we had gotten a glimpse of this gun. So I knew there was a gun in this house. There was never any violence, but I knew or remembered being shown the gun or told there was a gun, but I knew there was a gun. So when she said that to me, I said, Mommy, well, maybe you should hide the gun. That's what I said. And she kind of was very cavalier about it. She really was kind of just, she kind of glanced over, but she didn't seem worried or afraid. She just was like, yeah, he said he was going to kill me. So she left. And then the next day, which was a Sunday, she had just gotten home from church, and I was piddling around the house, just walking from room to room, waiting for my boyfriend, who then became my first husband, to come over. And as I'm walking, I walked into their room, and I saw this gun laying on the TV stand. And I remember the day before when she said that he said he was going to kill her. So I walked up to the gun, and the only reason why I felt confident to walk to the gun is because, as I said, my boyfriend had just got a security job where he used to carry a .357 Magnum, and he showed me how to open and close the gun. Other than that, I had never had any contact with a gun or probably wouldn't have approached this gun. But he showed me how to open a cylinder, you know, this kind of just showing off his gun for security. So I walked up to the gun, and I said to myself, I said, Mama didn't do what I said. She didn't hide the gun, you know. So I started to open the cylinder like my boyfriend had taught me, and then I started to open the cylinder, meaning I opened the gun, I turned it down. The bullets, which I believe were six, kind of slid into my palm of my hand, but not all the way out. And then I said, you know what? I'm being silly. They've been married for 32 years. But I was afraid to close. So I turned the gun back down. The bullets fell back in. But I was afraid to close it because it was an old, rusty, dusty gun. So I was afraid to close the gun. So I walked. They were in the kitchen. You know how, you know, the typical woman, she's in there preparing dinner. He's sitting at the table. You know, what we eating tonight? You know, stuff like that. So I walked in. He has something called a service porch, which most houses don't have service porch. So I'm standing on a service porch, and I say to him, I say, Mac, we called it Mac, not Grandpa. I said, Mac, I opened your gun, and I'm afraid to close it. So he takes the gun from me and sits back down and starts to lecture me on gun safety and says something like, you know, don't touch guns or, you know, this stuff. So I'm sitting there listening, and my grandmother, who was on the completely opposite side of the room, over by the stove, she picks up the gun and she starts to talk about the weight of it. She says, you know what, Very, who was some country cousin that we had, she said, Very has a gun like this. And as she started to talk about the gun and refer to how heavy it was, she intentionally turned it in the opposite direction.
Oh, I think you cut out, Sabrina. Hello? Okay, it looks like her call has dropped, so we are going to wait for her to call back in. But, oh, my gosh, I don't know about y'all, but I'm on pins and needles waiting to find out what happened with this gun. Like, you know, it's one thing when you grow up in a house that is filled with violence and things like that, and you kind of expect certain things, but then it's something totally different when you're not expecting it at all. So, Sabrina, okay, you're back in. I was just
yeah,
telling
I'm back.
Saying,
I'm sorry about that.
Like, I'm so, like, I'm on pins and needles for the rest of this story. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what happened was my grandmother, remember when I told you that she had mentioned it to me, she seemed very casual about it, but apparently, and this is me thinking in hindsight, why she picked up the gun. Maybe she was actually in more fear than she actually let on. So she picked it up, and she turned in the opposite direction of both of us, and when she kind of bounced it in her hand saying, this is heavy, this gun is really heavy, Very has a gun like this, when she went the down motion to bounce it, you know, to say how heavy it was, it fired. So it fired, and it went under the window, and in that moment, it scared me, so I ran, like, a little few feet off the service porch, and I heard my grandfather say, you tried to kill me. He said, you tried to kill me. I heard her chair, the screeching noise of the chair on the linoleum floor. I heard his chair. His chair screeched back when he got up and snatched the gun out of her hand, and I ran about 2 feet, and then I came back. And as I came back to approach the door to the kitchen, he took the gun out of her hand, and he shot her in the head. And I witnessed it. Yeah. So.
Oh, my God.
In that moment, I ran. Yeah. So I ran. I ran. Crazy. As I replay this in my head, I still dream about this exact moment today. This happened in 1987. So I ran down the street. And you know what? There is a part of you that is not connecting to what just happened. So I'm running, and I go to neighbors that we knew, and I'm like, you know, my grandfather just shot my grandmother. Max just shot mama. What? Max just shot mama. But somewhere I didn't believe she was dead. My grandmother was a devout Christian, and she taught me to believe in this God that, you know, was almighty. So it never dawned. I was in the police station hours later after, you know, they taped off the house and we went through all this and everybody showed up and all that stuff. It's just a blur. But I do remember sitting in the police station and, you know, they're coming to me and they sit me down and they're talking about, you know, I thought she was shot but maybe still alive. I never thought that she, this amazing woman who loved and honored God, who took on her grandchildren at such a young age, you know, babies, when she was almost 70, no way I thought that she had died. So in that moment, they're talking, and I'm just, remember, the 17-year-old brain is so different. I didn't have any idea that they were about to tell me that she was dead. So my life changed from that day. From that day forward, at this point, my mother was still on drugs. My father had died when I was 10. My father was a great guy. He just was an alcoholic. He loved me dearly. He loved my sister dearly, but he loved alcohol just a little bit more. So he never hurt us. He never abused us, but we did have many days of sitting on the porch waiting on him to show up to take us to the park, and he would come staggering down the walkway, drunk, too drunk to take us. But other than that, he loved us, and somehow he was able to communicate his love for us, but it just taught me that that love wasn't enough. To, you know, his love for alcohol was greater than his love for his only two children. So mm-hmm. my father had died when I was 10. So by the time I was 17, it was just my grandmother. My sister, who the one that was 11 months old, we were like 9 months apart. She had gone off to San Diego State University. So it was just me. Me, my grandmother, and my grandfather in the house 30 days before my graduation. So I went through a bunch of stuff, which I can't remember everything. I remember court. I remember just a bunch of craziness. It's just a haze. You know, people didn't believe in therapy then, so I definitely wasn't in contact with any therapist or anything like that back then. I just had to go on, put on my cap and gown 30 days later, Marcy, and graduate from high school and start my life by myself. No mother, no grandmother. Sister going to San Diego State, and, you know, and I did. I didn't have a choice, really, you know. But it did cause me to lose a lot of faith, you know, because when you say Almighty God, then I think Almighty. So that means I thought that God would figure out that something went wrong. This was a mistake. And he definitely, Marcy, definitely wouldn't leave me here to feel like it was my fault, to feel like if I would not have walked that gun into that kitchen on that moment at that night, that, you know, how was I supposed to live with that, you know?
Right, yeah, so, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it was, I don't even know how, because, so I remember, I mean, there was, Now, make no mistake, I loved my first husband, but there was really no other option. So that's why I got married at 18 years old. You know, there was nowhere to go, you know. So I didn't think of it like that then, but thank God.
Was he older than you? Was he older than you, or was that the same boyfriend?
No, same boyfriend. He's older. Yes, he's about 6-7 years older. He was at Grambling State University. About 6 years older than me. You know, nowadays, you can't do stuff like that. I know. I was just telling my daughter, nowadays, you cannot do that. But anyway, so we got married. I graduated from high school, and I went on with my life. Funeral happened. It was a blur. And I just went on with my life. I now can use the word suppressed. I suppressed that and just went on. I just, there was no, oh, you need therapy, or, oh, I didn't know I had post-traumatic stress until much, much later in life when somebody gave me that term. I was afraid of guns. I was afraid of men. My only reference of marriage was that 32-year relationship. My grandfather and grandmother had been married for 32 years. So this is where I formed my perception of what love looked like.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So at this point, I married my husband. So now I'm married. I'm 19 years old, married. Don't know nothing about this. At 17 was right around the time when my grandmother probably would have started teaching me that type of stuff. But I knew nothing about being a wife. You know, and then shortly after I became a mother. So I've got a baby. I'm young as all outdoors. I know nothing. I got post-traumatic stress, but I don't know I have post-traumatic stress. I just think I'm crazy, literally. I just think I'm acting a fool for no reason, meaning if a car would pull up on the side of us just parallel, like window to window, I would just start freaking out. You know, I didn't really know. Things were so different now. Nobody said, hey, this little girl got some trauma. You know,
right.
So I started to form. And so when my husband was a very good provider. However, he was a very jealous person. And he also, remember that 357 Magnum that he had, the one that he showed me how to open the cylinder. So we had our ups and downs. And when I would, one day I remember specifically, I had left him because he was a little bit abusive. He really was. He was abusive, but I only say that thinking back then because then I didn't know, because if a man kills a woman after 32 years, I didn't know what love was supposed to look like. So I know
right.
I sound like I'm not even making him take credit for that, because then I thought, oh, well, that's what you're supposed to do, you know? I mean, this is, so when he showed up, and I was trying to leave him, and then he pulls out that very 357 Magnum. You know, I'm like, and sits it on his lap like, oh, you leaving me? I really believed at that. I used to describe it as the devil told me I would also die by the hands of a man. I believe that's how love ends. If you could put in 32 years and your husband kills you, I believe that's how love ends. And I had no way of knowing that it didn't end that way. So when he put out a 357 Magnum on him, when I tried to leave that relationship, I remember sitting in that truck thinking like, oh, okay, devil. Oh, you was right. I'm going to die by the hands of a man. Oh, okay. I remember accepting that belief. And let me tell you something. Had I not went on a journey later and realized that I did not have to accept that belief, I probably wouldn't be alive today because it is done unto you as you believe. If I would have continued to believe that love ends in death and the man hurting you or killing you, I assure you I would have manifested just that into my life.
Yeah.
And it's really nothing but the grace of God, all the years that I didn't know better, you know, didn't know not to call that into my life, that I'm still here. I used to always say, how am I here? Why am I still alive? You know, I had so much trauma, and I was acting out for a while. So what happened was, which is really, really something that it took a lot of years for me to understand, because I didn't know what love looked like, and I thought that's what love looked like. If I got into a relationship with somebody who didn't act a fool or wasn't extremely jealous or wasn't violent or territorial, I thought they didn't love me.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't that something?
Well,
I
yeah,
they
because
did, and they did not.
And that makes that makes complete sense, because you were with him, so he's much older than you. He's 6 or 7 years older than you. You're 17, get married post-trauma of watching your mother, the woman who raised you your whole entire life, be murdered in front of the man who raised you your whole entire life. Like, who wouldn't at that? And, you know, like you said, things were so much different back in, you know, the 70s and the 80s and even the 90s where, you know, it just wasn't. You know, nobody talked about mental health. Like, you were either crazy or you were not crazy. You know, there was no in between. Right. There was no mental health. There was no therapy and counseling and PTSD and domestic violence. Like, we didn't even have those words. So, yeah, how do you at that point sort out what you're feeling and figure out, like, how do I compartmentalize these emotions? How do I know, you know, what's what? Like, I can't even imagine. And then, like you said, the dealing with the guilt, like, that's a whole other arm of trauma.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
And you know, I didn't know anything about, like, not feeling those feelings. Like, I would be depressed. I would be suicidal. Any other tragedy that would happen in my life, like my divorce, it would bring back the murder of my grandmother. It would bring back the abandonment of my mother, you know. So everything was a trigger for everything. And I did attempt to, as I went on, so I divorced him in 1996. And he was a great provider, like I said, so I had to take care of myself. And in high school in 1987, I saw somebody do some braids. You know, they were charging like $40 back in the day. As a matter of fact, my sister, the one that's 9 months older, she got her hair braided for $40 by this girl named Michelle. So I took that discarded hair when it was time to take those braids out, guarded hair off the floor, and braided my own head. My own hair was the first hair I ever braided. It probably looked atrocious, but I didn't know.
Now from the professional's eye, looking back, but probably back then you were probably like, oh yeah, I did that.
Yeah, absolutely, because what happened is I went on to the 12th grade, and in the 12th grade, and I started advertising, and I got some customers, and that started, that's when the braiding idea started. So then I married him, and it was, not even a year later, then I was Okay, I married him in 1987. Okay, my grandmother killed 87. The timelines, the years, but it's right. It's very close. Okay, so somewhere between 17 and 18, 19, all of this happened. I married him, and then and surprisingly had the courage to divorce this man. Now, that's, I always ask myself, how did I ever? Here I am on my own. At the time, we had one baby. Who gave me the courage to think that I could divorce this man? You know,
right.
I really think about that. Like,
and he was the sole provider for you at that point, right? He was
yes,
the sole provider for you, right?
Complete sole provider. So that's what happened. So when I did divorce him, I hadn't been braiding all that time, but I remembered that I had this as an option. You know, I had a little bit of customers here, but so I realized he wasn't going to keep paying my bills if I wasn't going to be with him. So sure enough, 1996 came. I rented my first apartment by myself. It was $500 a month. You know, those $500 apartments don't exist anymore. It was a two-bedroom.
Lord have mercy.
I had my little baby. And did you ever live in Los Angeles?
I never did, I'm from Iowa, LA was like, the only thing I knew about Los Angeles up until I was in my mid-30s was what I saw on TV. Like, I had never visited there, anything, and it wasn't until I moved to Arizona after I had gotten divorced and I got transferred and moved out here, I was like, wow, like, you know, you're driving down the freeway and you see the signs that say Los Angeles. I'm like, oh, my God, like, I'm by Los Angeles because I'm directionally challenged. So it didn't make no sense to me. But,
well, exactly. Speaking of the freeway, so what happened was when Rodney King got beat up or whatever happened, you know, they had the riots and it left a lot of vacant property. So those fences were the fences that I started advertising Braids by Sabrina on. I would go to Thrifty's, which I don't think exists anymore, and I would staple together two bright, gigantic, fluorescent pink and orange signs and make Braids. I would paint it myself by hand.
Wow.
Braids by Sabrina. And I would go put those, get the little ties, and I would go put those on the fences all over the city of LA. It was many a business that got burned. So it was a whole lot of opportunities for people to advertise on those fences. So that's how Braids by Sabrina was birthed. And that's how I was able to take care of myself without a husband and without any formal education, you know, other than a high school degree. You know, that's how Braids by Sabrina was born. Now, I was just trying to make money just to take care of me and my baby. I had no idea that Braids by Sabrina was going to turn into this gigantic, you know, business. So I'm in the house, in the same little $500 a month apartment, and I've got customer after customer. Do you know, Marcy, that I still have those appointment books from 1996? I still have
you
them.
You do?
And I look through. I was charging $40, $60. I'm not waking up in the morning for $40 now,
Now, how much do you, okay, so for comparison's sake, because, you know, I've never had my hair braided because I don't have that kind of hair, right? They just, everything falls out. So how much in comparison, so one of the hairstyles that you did back then for $40, how much does that cost now?
If I was still doing it, it would cost about $460.
Wow.
Yeah. but
that's crazy.
And I say if I was still doing it because I don't actually do braids anymore. When I turned 50, I put in 26 years, and I was facing some health challenges at the time, and I really sat out and I prayed about it, and I was like, listen, God, in order for me to maintain the level of vibration that I need to heal my own body, because I believe that God has given us the ability to heal our own bodies, not that I'm saying don't go to the doctor. Along with the doctor's instructions, we have the ability to heal our own bodies. So I knew after 26 years and over 1,700 employees, the drama that and the stuff they send you through, the stress, the worrying about them treating customers, I was done. So what happened is I was thinking about it, and I had already been thinking about it. And prior to me beginning to think about it, I never envisioned not having a full staff, because I always had a full staff, you know, and they always worked on commission, so which was 40% no matter what. I'm a Leo, so it's always been, I had these strict rules that I made from day one. And one was, if they did a hit for $100, they got $60, I got $40. Right then, right there, that day, on the spot.
That's so fun.
So I had gotten to a point where the braiders were causing me more trouble than they were worth. They were really kind of ruining the name that I had built, because they didn't have the passion. They didn't have the work ethic. There are a few over here. You just can imagine having so many employees and not having really any real experience in how to deal with these people. So I learned by trial and error, meaning the first few years, Marcy, I was hanging out with them. We were going to the club. I was inviting them to my house. But it took me 10 years to learn that you can't hang out with your employees and expect them to show up to work on time the next day. So as the years went by, I mean, years, I stopped counting at 1,700. I'm pretty sure it's greatly surpassed that. And I had about five or six very, very interesting men as well, you know. So I was tired. So here I have this health challenge at the time, which actually is a brain tumor, okay? So in 2017, now, I was already a little bit frustrated, because by this time I'm this extremely positive person that believes we can heal our own bodies, that believes that you can manifest perfect health and abundant wealth. So I'm like, God, really? For real? A tumor? Really, God? So I sit down and I pray. I had this one girl working for me that was driving me up a wall, and she was a functional addict, and I didn't know. I mean, I just thought she had very erratic behavior, constantly apologizing to customers because she was late. And I said, you know what? I am 50 years old. I refuse to continue to go. And at this point, in my own chair, I was doing nothing under $640. So I sat down for a second and I prayed about it. And I said, listen, God, I have given this business 20-some years. At the time, it was maybe a little less, maybe like 24, 25 years. I have given this business this many years. I'm tired of having to have an open door policy, having to monitor these employees. You have made it, God, to where I make an astronomical amount of money in my own chair. So I'm really thinking about getting rid of the Braids by Sabrina part of the business, right? So I sat down and I prayed about it. I meditated on it. I did my little sound bowl. I really, really was serious. And you would think it would take you forever to come up with a name if you're going to change a name after 20-some years. You would think you'd need paper and noses. God said, it's a new day, a new vision. I changed Braids by Sabrina from Braids by Sabrina to a New Vision Dreadlock Studio in 7 days flat. I called the printers. I called the sign people. I called everything in 7 days. The sign was taken down for Braids by Sabrina. A New Vision Dreadlock Studio was put up. All the cards, all the business cards, all the flyers, everything was changed in 7 days. Couldn't be number God. God gave me that name.
Wow.
And then I raised my price. At that point when I did it, I was probably at like a $460 minimum. Then I raised my prices to $640 minimum. I'm not waking up in the morning for less than $640. And you know, there's a fear that can be associated with that as well, but you have to get past that fear and believe that abundance is real. And, you know, I have put in my time. I'm excellent at what I do. I changed the voicemail, everything. You know, I got $640 minimum. What's your price to start at? $640. I haven't looked back
yet. So let me ask you this, Sabrina, because I think that's a really good point when we talk about pricing ourselves. And sometimes I think exactly what you're saying, like we underestimate or undervalue, like even though we know we're skilled, we know that we have a certain talent or a certain skill set that's worth, and you know that there's people out there commanding those types of money, but how do you mentally get beyond the point where you're like, you know what? Yeah, I'm just raising the price. Like, I'm not even thinking twice. I'm not blinking about it. I'm not nothing. Like, let's just go with this.
Like, how, what, was there something that kind of triggered you? Like, what made you make that? Because that's a substantial price jump.
It is. So what happens is you already have to be on this journey. So I started the journey of transformation and healing, you know, maybe in my 40s, somewhere in there. So you already have to be on this journey. And my journey began with a book called The Untethered Soul, right? So The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer is the first time I ever in my life heard of mind chatter. And there was this little self-defeating voice in our head talking to us, telling us lies and telling us stuff that's not true, and we don't have to listen to those lies, you know? So in regards to money, when you, that fear, that, girl, ain't nobody going to pay those prices. Girl, you ain't worth that. You can't charge that. That's that self-defeating voice. So The Untethered Soul was my introduction to the fact that that self-defeating voice existed. Now, when I applied it to my trauma, you know, Marcy, I was indeed an abandoned child. I was indeed put in a suitcase and my mother tried to take my life. However, I am the one that continued to remind myself of that. It is that voice in my head that I listen to and believe. You know, people don't, on the street in Target don't know that. They weren't people walking up to me on the street and saying, Sabrina, hey, don't get too high on your horse. You know you was a abandoned child. You know you wasn't wanted from birth, so you know you're not going to amount to nothing. Nobody ever said that to me in my life. I told myself that. So once I learned through this, this book was just a catalyst. This book, and honestly, I know this sounds so cliche, but it's just the truth. This book and the introduction to The Secret. So when I grew up in Compton, we had this boy who went to jail for carjacking, because carjacking was big back then, right? He went to jail, and when he got out of jail, he looked me up. We all grew up, we were the kids playing jump rope and jacks, all on 126th Street in Compton. He got out of jail for carjacking, and he came and found me just to say hi, you know, neighborhood kids. When he walked into my place of business, this man, that been in jail for 10 years, said, "You must know The Secret." I was like, and at this time, I had no idea what he was talking about. He said, "You must know The Secret." But I'm the type of person, you don't have to tell me twice. So I was like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You live like you know The Secret." And I was like, "Oh, what's that? Man, when I tell you we got in that car, I didn't know about a book then. I went and found it at Target for $9.99 on video, on DVD.
I love that video. Mm-hmm, I love that movie.
I watched it 100 times. And that, so Michael Singer's Untethered Soul and The Secret. And that, so once I watched it, I realized I had already unconsciously or subconsciously been living that way. You know, but I now imagine what I can do intentionally. Because everything else I manifested by accident, by default. Because I didn't know what I didn't know nothing about The Secret. But once I learned that, that was just a catalyst. You know, what you seek, Marcy, is seeking you. So when you begin this journey, God and the universe attracts everything to you that is vibrating at that level. So that was just a catalyst. And after that, I would read more books and more books and more books, and I would start to transform my mindset. And I would realize that I did not have to continue to sit up and cry over a woman that only had me in her possession for 3 months. This woman had me in her possession for 3 months, Marcy, and I'm sitting up here crying over her at 45 years old, right? So with that, I decided to go find her. I went to find my mother. Now I knew where she was. She lived in the jungles. It's like a project over here, you know, but I never felt compelled to go find her and have a conversation. Never. Now, she had been rehabilitated for 20-some years. However, there were other children. My mother had four children, so six children she spit out and dumped off like a puppy, right? I had little cameo relationships with those children, but a lot of them have their own severe past trauma, so it was difficult to build adult relationships with them. And each of us have our own cross to bear. Each of us have our own issues as a result of being born to this woman. So anyway, when I was 45, God was changing me. Now, I didn't know that then. I was like, what is going on? Why am I changing? What's different? What's wrong? You know, just God was changing me. He really was. And I laughed because I some of the things that I was attracted to, some of the men I had, and I could just be honest, I had big time drug smuggling boyfriends. That's all we knew from Compton, right?
Right.
I had them, and I had me over here thinking I knew what love looked like. So I'm manifesting these dysfunctional territorial relationships. This is just a blessing I'm alive. So, but as time went on, I started to not be attracted to that behavior anymore. You know?
Yeah.
I started to just be like, something was changing. I couldn't even explain it. Really, I couldn't. But I felt it. On the inside, I felt it. It was so powerful. So this compulsion led me to go and have a sit-down conversation with my mother at 45 years old. I'm 53 now. And at 45, I went up to this little raggedy apartment where she lives in the jungles, and I took a tape recorder. I didn't know what to expect, but I figured it might be emotional, so I want to record it so I can listen to it later. Now, at this point, my mother's rehabilitated for 26 years. She is legally blind and got a lot of health issues as a result of so many years on drugs. I also have a sister that was there as well, one of my mother's children that she had sent through a bunch of abuse. So I go in, and I'm sit down, and I start asking her questions that I never even had the desire to ask her in life. I just never cared. I used to always be like, F her. I really used to say, if somebody said William, I would be like, F her. I don't care if she died. I used to say that. I'd be like, F her. If she didn't love me, I don't love her. You know? So I sat down, and I started asking my mother these questions, like, how did you meet my father, who was 20 years her senior? Who introduced you to drugs? And then I found myself, Marcy, wanting her to give me an excuse of her horrible life so that I could forgive her for being a horrible parent. I wanted her to tell me some horrible story of abuse and abandonment and stuff she'd been through and why she became who she was. But she was like, she was born in Texas as well, a little place called Waxahachie, Texas. She was the only child, and everybody loved her. That's what she said. I was like, were you hurt? Were you abused? Did somebody molest you? Nothing. You know, I was grabbing for straws, like, what could possibly make you give birth to six babies and spit about like a puppy and keep going? You know, so, but no, she did not have that story. She was like, no, I was the only child. Everybody loved me, right? So I was like, okay. So she told me the story of who introduced her to drugs, how she got on drugs, how she met my father. She said she loved my father very much. You know, just, it was a conversation that I actually cannot believe. I never cared about any of those answers until that moment in my life. So then I did ask her this. I said, listen, all my life I've hated you because I was told that you put me into a suitcase and tried to kill me when I was a three-month-old baby. Is this true? You know, because I started to think, like, have I hated this woman for something that's got twisted, a story that got twisted, it's not even true. But sure enough,
right.
So my mother, now, in this moment, Marcy, you have to know, I was waiting on pins and needles for her to say, baby, I'm so sorry. She rehabilitated now. 26 years. So I was waiting on her to say, I'm so sorry. I love you. It was the drugs. Forgive me. She looked in my direction because she's legally blind. And she said, I said, did you really put me in a suitcase and try to kill me as a 3-month-old baby? And she looked up and she said, yeah, I did, because you cried too damn much.
Oh my gosh.
So, she said you cried.
Let me ask you this though. And then remind me. I want to come back to talk about faith in a second. But do you think that had she not been on the drugs, that number one, the crying would have affected her that way, and number two, that she would have behaved that way?
Well, that's the point. That's my point. Because she was off drugs now, 26 years, I expected a different type of love and compassion from her. Instead of her saying, yes, I did it, because you cried. Not yes, I did it, and I'm so sorry I did it, but yes, I did it, and now I'm going to still make it your fault because you cried too darn much as a baby. You was a crybaby. That's what, you know what I'm saying? That's so... That made me.
So she kind of planted her feet with that. Like,
Yeah. Like, I'm sold out to that. Like, no, you got on my last nerve.
Yeah.
And basically,
absolutely.
Did she come across like she didn't have no regrets for it? Like, this shit happened?
None. Absolutely. She
wow.
did not. So, but this is the thing, though. God prepared me for that. So, had I not started the journey of transformation, of healing and transformation, had I not already been on the road to recovery from all that, healing those holes, I call them holes. Like, we walk around with these gigantic holes in our heart that other people cannot see. Past trauma causes gigantic holes, right? And so many things happen. I believe that little pieces of our soul escape through these holes. They escape. Trauma, molestation, the murder. Little pieces of our soul escape through these gaping holes. And as we go throughout our life, 20, 30, 40, we're trying to retrieve these pieces of ourselves and piece ourselves back together again, you know? So had I not already started to close my holes, I probably would have reacted completely differently. Little black girl from Crampton, I probably would have snatched her around her throat. You understand? I really would have reacted differently. However, God was already transforming me. So, and I realized in that moment, I thought I was there for her. I thought I was there to hear her say the right words, say, oh, I'm sorry, forgive me. God showed me, you know, I don't know, you ever heard people say, when you get this, it's like a download from God. It's like not even like words, but it's like download. So instant download. As soon as she said, yeah, I did it because you cried too damn much, there was an instant download from God. This information that said, ha, see, you thought that she was going to say everything that you wanted her to say, and then you were going to then deem her worthy of your forgiveness between me and her. That's not why I sent you here. You know, I'm saying all this is an instantaneous, instant download from God. You have to forgive her anyway because I have greater for you. And you not forgiving her and this pain and this resentment is holding you back. All of that came at one time, like, bam, right? So I looked up, I looked at her, and I said, I forgive you too. And I said, I forgive you. And she said, I forgive you too. And
wow.
I could have said, the old me would have said, for what? Crying? Are you kidding me? Because I was transforming. I didn't say anything. I said, okay. You know, see, because ego, not that we aren't justified, Marcy, when people hurt us, when people abandon us. It's normal to expect the person that gave birth to you to love you. However, it's ego that makes us say, when this person says A, B, C, D, E, and F, then I say, okay, they deserve forgiveness. That's between her and God. It ain't none of my business. She can go to her grave and never, you know, that's between her and God. Have nothing to do with it. God's trying to elevate me mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. And I'm sitting over here still crying over her. And she ain't thinking about me. She's still justified putting me in a suitcase 26 years. You know, no, 45 years later. I'm 45 years old, and this is what you
almost
have to say.
Almost 50 years later, too. Like, nope, I was right.
Are you kidding,
shut
me,
up.
Ma'am?
You're absolutely right about the forgiveness part, and that's what I tell, you know, even my clients and stuff when we're talking about forgiveness. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, you're forgiving for you, not for them. But nobody really tells you how that works. And understanding that exactly what you're saying, and that's why I tell my clients, like, your anger and resentment has you in bondage. Mm-hmm. They're not walking around thinking about you. They're not walking around. She probably hadn't thought about the day she put you in that suitcase since
absolutely.
The day she did it. But
absolutely.
You, like you said, like,
absolutely.
I'm crying over this for 45 years later, mm-hmm. and for what?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the
right.
piece where people, you know, when they're trying to learn how do you bridge from anger and resentment to forgiveness, that's how you do it. Like, you have to have that realization, that real solid talk with yourself. Like, they don't
mm-hmm.
give a damn. Like, they just don't.
Like,
and it hurts when you have to admit that, but they don't.
Yeah, I had to realize that, like you said, she wasn't thinking about me. Or making amends
mm-hmm.
for nothing she has done to any of her six children. And I was causing the self-torment. I was doing it. And since I was replaying it and I was reminding myself that I wasn't worthy because my mama didn't want me, since I was the one making that choice to keep pressing play on all of my past trauma, I had to stop playing that movie and move on. So what happened is I used to have this saying back then called forgive to live. You have to forgive in order to live. Once I made the choice to forgive, I was able to live. And let me tell you this story, and this is so amazing because I put this in my book because it's just freaking amazing, right? So I described this apartment as this little dirty place in the jungles for a reason, because I want you to get a visual on. It's just a little raggedy apartment in the jungle. Simple as that. So, which is a project. So, as we finished our conversation, and once I said, you know, I forgive you, we talked a little bit more, and then I was it. I left. Got my tape recorder, and I left. I step out onto the same little step that I stepped into this apartment in, Marcy, and for some reason, the grass. It was this beautiful color green. And I was looking down. I said, oh, my God, look at this beautiful grass. This grass is so pretty. And I'm just standing there on the same step in the same little raggedy, seedy, dark, dirty apartment. And so then I look up to the sky, and I was like, oh, my God, look at the blue sky. Why is the sky so blue today? Really, this is just, I wish people were videotaping stuff then. I was like, oh, my God. It was like this whole veil of how I had seen the world. I wasn't even able to live until I made the choice to forgive. I wasn't able to take part in the beauty of this amazing world until I walked out of that apartment and told my mother I forgive her. And I saw the grass, a beautiful different color green. It was vibrant. This is the same grass in the same sky that existed when I walked in. But when I let that go, it was so amazing. And the reason why that was so significant, because I had also years prior on my journey read a book called Embraced by the Light by Betty Eady. And she had an out-of-body experience and God showed her heaven and how, you know, the flowers were just so bright. And you see, we are seeing a limited view when we are filled with hate and anger and resentment, no matter what, even if it's justified. Because people always say, well, but you don't know what they did and you don't know how bad it is. Yes, I do, and I understand. Whatever story you got, I got another one for you. You understand? So I do understand it. But forgiving doesn't take away or justify the hurt or that someone has given to you, but you're suffering. You're causing hell on earth, a hellish experience on earth, when God wants us to have a heaven on earth. We don't know what's next. Marcy, I'll tell you something. I was raised Church of God in Christ, Bishop E. Cleveland, Jr., and Senior, but we do not know what is next after we leave this earth. So,
let me stop you for a second. So I want to ask you about faith, because, you know, I understand the growing up in church and, you know, your grandmother instilling that in you. But when you go from, you know, 45, 50 years with this story about being put in the suitcase and discarded by your mother, and then watching your grandmother being murdered and then holding on to the guilt, like if I just kind of brought the gun in there, maybe it wouldn't have happened. Like, you're replaying all these stories. How do you reconcile, or how did you reconcile to still be able to trust God? Because, and I know for y'all that are listening, I know this is not, we didn't come here to talk about, we would come talk about business, but this is important. And so y'all know it's the conversation somebody needs to hear. That's what I believe to be true. So I want to know, how did you reconcile your relationship with God and not get angry with him as a result of the traumas that you've been through? Because you still speak so highly of God and your relationship with God and the power of faith and how faith has really transformed you in so many ways. And so where does that reconciliation, how did that happen?
That's now, so let's just be clear, that is today. That is I did lose my faith all of my 20s and my 30s. I was mad at God. I thought he had abandoned me, period. Simple as that. I needed him to come on down here from heaven himself and prove to me that he was real if I was going to continue.
Nope, I think we lost you again, Sabrina. Are you with me? Okay, guys, let's give her a minute to get reconnected. But for those of you who are listening, and if you have a question or you have a comment, the phone lines are open. It's 914-219-0880. And I know Sabrina's been sharing a lot with us tonight. I knew she had a powerful story, but as oftentimes happens when folks come on to B2B, I don't even know the depth of their story until they get on and they really start, we're diving in. And so, yes, we're talking about Black business. She's a successful Black business owner, but I really feel like we always talk about with B2B that, you know, when we come into this room and we start having these conversations, that this is a conduit for healing. And so, like I tell you all the time, like the beginning of every show, we're talking about we want to have the conversations that you need to hear. And so I think somebody needs to hear this about this forgiveness, because if you can forgive somebody for all the things that she had been through, then you can truly, truly, truly be able to set yourself free and live and experience a whole entirely different life. So Sabrina's back. So we were talking about faith, and you said you had lost your faith in God. You needed him to come down and really show you. Like, he owes you an explanation.
No, really. Absolutely. What I needed, honestly, and was serious about, and the reason why I was serious about this overt proof was because I was raised in a church where people had these amazing testimonies and proof that God was real. You understand? I grew in the Christian church. People get up on Sunday and tell you their proof, like, this happened to me. And I remember specifically this one lady saying her husband had died in the bed, and she got on top of him, and she prayed and pled the blood of Jesus over him, and he came back to life. I remember that story. So, therefore, I'm saying now, Lord, show me a sign. Come on down here, stand in front of me, prove to me that you're real, and then I'll continue to believe. Because at this point, you let a woman who raised two babies at 70 and was a devout Christian and loved and honored you, you let her get her head blown off. So I really was mad. Make no mistake. Angry.
Uh-huh.
I didn't step foot in the church in my 20s and my 30s at all. And when I went through a severe depression. See, this is why you do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm going to say this not to offend anyone who is still active in the Christian church. I am grateful for my foundation in the Christian church. However, I do feel there is a piece missing over there, because what happened is when I went through severe depression, the only reason why I didn't kill myself is because that foundation of suicide being the unforgivable sin, I would have to go to hell. Okay? So that's why you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That believing that kept me on earth. Now, although I do believe that, like I said, there's a piece missing over there. You know, so what happened is I started stepping my foot out of the Christian church. I went to Bali, Indonesia. I went to Egypt. I went to spiritual temples, Hindu temples. I went to the Theosophy Society. I joined the conscious community. I did it all, okay? I did it all because at first, initially, I church hopped. I went to this church, Baptist, Pentecostal, everything, trying to heal. Why am I sad? Why am I depressed? Why am I scared of God? Why? And I was, and just pray about it was the answer. I was just pray about it was not enough. It was not healing me. It was not helping me. And I was in distress. However, you know, you can't really say that to everyone. So. So I started my own journey. So what happened is when I stepped foot out of the Christian church and I realized that that the control that we have over our own lives and our own suffering, you know, that God has given us the tools along, right, to heal ourselves. We waiting on Jesus to return to be happy and to be prosperous and to heal from past trauma when he has already given us the tools. So unlike most people, now let me be clear, most people do indeed throw the baby out with the bathwater. Most people who go on the journey that I go on, especially once they join that conscious community, they completely denounce the Christian church. On the other hand, was able to find correlation, right? Meaning, okay, you know, And I was also able to appreciate that moment and time in my life for what it was. But my journey took me out of the Christian church, not to denounce God, not to say I don't believe in Jesus, because I actually do. I actually still believe in Jesus, which is why the people at the concert community, they was like, girl, no. You know, they went overboard trying to tell the letter J, don't exist, you know. And I was like, listen,
they about to put you out. They about to put you out for that, huh?
Yeah, they were. I was like, first of all, y'all are way too aggressive. And if this is what being enlightened and you know, living your higher self look like, then y'all missing something too. So then I ran over to the Theosophy Society. I studied Madame Blavatsky, and you know, I've done it all trying to find what God meant to me. And that is what I would urge every individual to find, what God meant to them, and understand that God is within you. The kingdom of heaven is within you. And we also have to learn to lay that ego down and allow people to honor and respect God the way that they do, and not force our beliefs on them. And that's what happened when I went to Bali, Indonesia. These amazing, beautiful people, let's be clear. These people are amazing. They're ready to serve. They are kind. They don't ask you what color you are. They don't ask you nothing. I'm in a spiritual temple, in a Hindu temple in Bali, Indonesia, next to a man with a big turban on and all what he got going on. They never turn to you and say, well, what faith are you? Are you Christian? They don't care. They love you. But only in America are we so egotistical that we want to argue with our cousins at the barbecue about their religion. So when you learn to lay that down and you go find God, you go find your heart. That's why my book is called My Spiritual Smile. As a business owner in the Los Angeles community who was kind of halfway cute, I was always smiling on the outside, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
On the inside, I was broken. So
yeah.
The book is called My Spiritual Smile, Tools for Mental and Mental and Emotional Transformation. And that is so significant because the church, just pray about it, is not practical. We need practical tools to help heal ourselves from past trauma. We need practical tools to understand how to get up out of bed when we are suicidal. When, you know, we need the tools. So I walk people through the actual tools. Now, like I was saying, my journey still put me in a circle to where I still, at the end of the day, said, well, you know what? I still actually believe in Jesus. I still believe in Jesus. I just believe that Jesus was here to let us know, like, you ain't got to even be impressed by these miracles. I perform it because you have the ability to do that and more. You know, I believe Jesus was simply here to show human beings of the power that they have inside. He let us know, you know, you can do it. You can do even more greater things. With the power that we have inside, and that's why that power begins with the mind, utilizing the mind, believing in things unseen as if they already are, believing, seeing your healing, seeing your business, seeing that new husband you want or whatever, seeing it, believing it, feeling it, allowing yourself to get into the emotion of it. I have a chapter called Creative Visualization where you literally have to pretend like children. You take a 2 and 3 year old and put them in the corner and watch them. They're not even playing with nobody. They are pretending. Their imagination is God, like Neville Goddard said. So that's how I was able to, you know, reconcile my religion. You know, and because I am a speaker, you know, in certain forms, I can wrap it in any package you want. You know, because I have a religious background. There, you know, I can quote a scripture too. However, I quote scriptures like Medea, so I don't do it too much. But I have been asked many times. I do. But I've
been
asking
like Madea. No, but you know, I'm really glad that you broke that all the way down because, you know, for one thing, a lot of times people are like, well, just pray about it, but they're not doing anything else, you know, and so you can't put like the onus isn't on God to heal everything for you. Like you're saying, like we have tools, we have resources available to us, and we have the ability to do some of the work on our own, and allowing prayer to be more of a support system than a crutch. And I think a lot of times people want to use religion and prayer and God as a crutch and to absolve them of their own responsibility to make some conscious and proactive choices of their own. And so, you know, we probably both about to get some hate mail about what we're talking about. But again, I really feel like somebody needs permission to be able to go on that journey, because when we are brought up in certain circles and, you know, we're taught certain things in our generational systems of origin and all that kind of stuff, like, you don't question that stuff. You know,
you don't know that you can question it.
Right. Like, that was not, you don't question your elders. You don't talk back. You don't, you know, you don't question anything. Mm-hmm. So whatever we were taught as little people, then that's what we take with us into adulthood. And that's what we build what we think is our truth on. And our truth sometimes is built on false structures and faltering foundations. And so to be able to go on that, that journey, to be able to say, like, you know, I tested out some other religions. I tested out some other theologies. I tested out some other systems, and I built my relationship with God. And I think sometimes we want to have, be able to just grab the Bible and say, here, it's like it's a recipe book. And it's like, no, there might be some ingredients, but
so
you
glad.
Have to do it yourself.
Yep, you do, and that's the key. And that's really, that is truly, like you said, they use it as a question. They don't realize that you got to get out there and get to digging yourself for your own life experience. If you want to be happy here, you want to be healthy here, you want to be wealthy here, you know, you have to get out there and figure out how to manifest that yourself, you know, and understand that God is giving you the power. God, and I'm also at a point, Marcy, where I don't get caught up in it. You don't have to call the divine source what I call the divine source. You don't have to say God. You can say universe. You can say unheard, Yahweh. I don't care. But there are people
right.
that get so upset with you if you don't use their terminology. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah,
focusing on the wrong thing.
Absolutely. There is clearly a divine source working in your favor. If I was sitting next to you right now and I took my fingers and I scratched your arm and left a welt, whether you go put alcohol on that or not, Marcy, it is going to heal in 3 days, meaning there is a divine source working in your favor no matter what. You don't have nothing to do with programming how much blood goes through your arteries and how much oxygen goes through your lungs in the middle of the night. Clearly, there's a divine source.
Right. So let me ask you this.
So I don't care what a person calls.
Mm-hmm. Right. So on the business side of it, then, with when you've gone through all this, you sort of accidentally build this million-dollar business, doing hair.
Right.
But I think you did, if I remember correctly, didn't you? Like, weren't you part of, like, or maybe the catalyst for, like, changing some laws for hair braiders or something?
Yeah.
Like, I want to say I remember that story from somewhere. Is that true? Is that you?
Yes.
Okay, will you share that part? Because that's massive. Like, that's such a big deal.
Okay, so in 1996, they came into my salon, and they were attempting to make braid salon owners who only do natural hair care get a cosmetology license, okay, so they could tax us and, you know, monitor how much money we're making or whatever. I don't know what the real purpose was, but we don't, in my salon was a natural hair care salon. We never did press and curl, perms, or anything. So what happened is they came in, they tried to find me, shut me down. They took little bitty menial things like clips and combs and tried to say I was violating something. So I was pushed into this political arena that I knew nothing about. Okay, but I had to fight for my business. That's all I had. So I had to go to Sacramento and understand what the laws were and understand what we had to lobby to do to get the State Board of Cosmetology to separate natural hair care salon owners from people who, cosmetologists and barbers, who were actually using chemicals. Or the definition of cosmetology is the alteration of natural hair. The minute you take a press and comb to your hair, you are altering natural hair. We weren't doing any of that. So I fought not even knowing how to fight. I'm telling you, I learned by trial and error by going through this arena. And then later I had another politician. We got that law passed. Each state has to lobby for this bill for themselves. So each state has different laws. some states still require them to do 200 or 300 hours of cosmetology, but the state of California, we were successful in lobbying to get natural hair care providers separate from state board and cosmetology rules and regulations. Now, as long as we had our professional occupations and commercial business licensing, then we could run our businesses. Simple as that, you know. And I was in the end, I'm so grateful that that happened, but as it was happening, I had no desire to even be part of it. I just wanted to go braid some hair and pay my bills. I didn't, you know anything
right.
about what I had got thrust into. I really didn't. But in hindsight, yeah, so I became the poster girl for changing the law in the state of California, allowing other salon owners to be able to, natural hair care salon owners, to be able to operate without being harassed by the State Board of Cosmetology.
So how did you, so, okay, because a lot of times as entrepreneurs, you know, you run into these, that's a big hurdle. That's a big thing, like when the state mm-hmm. comes for you. But, you know, we can run into these roadblocks and bump our heads on stuff. And sometimes that's enough to get an entrepreneur to quit. And especially I think sometimes as Black business owners, you know, we kind of feel like kind of sort of stacked against us to begin with. And so, you know, we all kind of come up with the mindset, like, we got to run twice as fast and lift twice as much and, you know, work twice as hard. And, you know, true or not, and we could, that's a whole different show, but that's enough to make people quit. Like, you have the whole
right.
entire state of California coming for you in your little shop in freaking, you were in Compton, right?
Right. No, I wasn't. I'm from Compton. The first time I opened, I was on Normandy at 65th Street, which is like West Los Angeles.
Okay. But, I mean, that's intimidating. It's overwhelming, I can imagine. So what made you say, you know what, I'm going to fight. I'm not going to let you just tell me what I got to do.
You know, I wish I could tell you, because I don't remember having that defining thought. It just never... I didn't have a choice. At this point, I had 2 kids, so there was nowhere to go. You know, there was no mama, grandmama house, nobody go to, nobody help. So I didn't have a choice. So the
mm-hmm.
idea of quitting never dawned on. It just never dawned on me. You know, and I don't know if I've ever been asked that question, because when I'm sitting here thinking of it with my mouth open, like, wow, you know, it never. I couldn't quit. I could not quit. I had 2 babies to take care of, and I had to pay my own bills.
But I mean, a lot of small business owners and entrepreneurs would have said, you know what, this, like, they gonna do what they gonna do. That's the state. Like, I might as well just go get a job. Let me go ahead and go to school and do whatever, you know, they're telling me I gotta do so I can keep my shop open. But you're like, nah, I'm not feeling any of that. Like, let's go. Let's go.
I don't
I'll
even
see
know.
You in court.
I,
that's crazy.
I mean,
like, it's so amazing to me.
Yeah, I just that drive had to be natural instinct, Marcy, because it just wasn't. It wasn't even. I can't even tell you a time when I sat down and said and made the decision to fight. It just happened. It unfolded that way. I didn't have a choice. You know, if I was going to survive out here and take care of these kids and pay my own bills, I didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't have a choice. So I'm grateful for that spirit inside. Maybe it's the lion in me. I'm a Leo.
There's definitely something there, because, you know, the watching your grandmother and then a month later having to, you know, walk across the stage and graduate, and then you're marrying this guy at 17 or 18. Like, don't, like you said, I don't know the first thing about being a wife, let alone a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being the, like you said, the captain of the cheerleading squad, like all of that. And like, that's back in the, you know, the mid 80s, like things were different
mm-hmm.
then. Like, diversity was different.
And
racial makeup were different.
I made a lot of choices based on trauma. So I even had my second marriage was built based on trauma as well. I only knew my husband for 5 months. Okay. So when you don't have love from the beginning of your life, when you get it, you grasp it. You like, oh, you love
yeah.
me. Oh, okay, we get married, right? So So my second marriage, I knew my husband for 5 months, and I was just like, you know, it's just an underlying subconscious fear that you won't be loved. So
yeah.
I don't know. I just do. I'm starting now, to be honest, because, you know, I know I'm starting now to feel like I know we have free will. I do believe that we have free will and control over our own lives, but I do believe that there is a destined path, you know. So there are a lot of the moves that I made back then, reason why I just can't, I can't think of a defining time, a moment, or conversation that pushed me down that path. I do believe that the divine source must intervene sometimes when we're distraught or just in distress, because I don't know. You know, I don't know how I ended up as Raised by Sabrina, being that I was sad, depressed, suicidal, you know, didn't want to live. I don't, I really, it had to be God moving through me when I couldn't carry. You know, you ever seen that footprint picture where you can't carry yourself, so Jesus is carrying the lady,
yes,
and leaving the
uh-huh.
footprint?
Absolutely.
It had to be something like that. It had to be. And I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful. But then it makes me think, wait, am I somehow on my destined path? Or was this my destiny? Was it going to happen? Even if I would have, because of free will, we might take little shortcuts, you know, to deter us for a few years. But could it have been my destined path? And if so, I'm so grateful. You know, I'm truly grateful. Because it could, you know, coming from where I came from, I used to always tell people, with a drug addict mother and an alcoholic father, if I would have ended up on drugs, you know, people would have just expected that. They didn't have any expectations,
yeah,
of what I would have been. I definitely wouldn't have been a successful business owner and a homeowner or any of that.
Right. Well, and to be, you know, to literally be an icon in, you know, California history books. You know, you were a trailblazer, and all those things. And to your point, nobody would have said anything to the contrary had you resorted to drugs or alcohol or,
right,
you know, other vices, like, oh yeah, that
mm-hmm.
was her, she get that from her mama, like, type of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And so the fact that you have the tenacity, and, you know, thank God for your grandmother while you had her, because it sounds mm-hmm. like, you know, I kind of alluded to that early in the show about how I'm sure she probably instilled a lot of the things in you that's manifesting now and that's coming out. So real quick, we got about 4 minutes left on the show. I want you to explain really quickly about in 59 seconds, and then I want you to share with folks how they can link up with you.
Okay. So as I, you know, on this journey, it's not always a great day. Some days, no matter what, even once you learn the tools of healing and transformation, even once you learn the tools to make you feel better, to raise your own vibration, there might be a day where you might wake up and you're still sad and you're still depressed, or you gained a few pounds and you're like, oh my God. So I created the In 59 Seconds movement to show people, especially business owners and mothers and people who have things to do, that it doesn't take a lot of time to commit to your own personal development. 59 seconds. If you just get up in that mirror for 59 seconds, even if you don't feel like it, and say, I am amazing, I am beautiful, I am smart, I am worthy. If you take 59 seconds and turn to those babies that you drive into school and remind them of their greatness and tell them that they can do anything, that 59 seconds can change the course of your day. That 59 seconds can change the course of their lives, if done consistently. So people think, oh, I don't have time to read. I can't do that. I have time to read. I don't have time to do this or go to a seminar. 59 seconds to uplift, motivate, and encourage yourself and another human being can make a difference in your life and the lives of others. That's why I created the In 59 Seconds movement. And everything, hashtag In 59 Seconds, is you can find me on every forum, Instagram, In 59 Seconds, or Sabrina Fisher Reese, FisherReese. Those names are hashtag In 59 Seconds on anything from TikTok to Instagram to Facebook, and you will find me.
Yeah, and you do some really great motivational videos and messages that are, like you said, like, it's just a short, quick little message, but you know, to somebody who's feeling down, it does make a difference. And so for, you know, anybody who's listening, not to underestimate, like Sabrina's saying, what you can do in a short amount of time. It doesn't take a lot to make a big difference. Like, you, not a big effort at all. Just being intentional about what you're doing and what you're going through. So, Sabrina, thank you so much. Like, we kind of talked about a little bit of everything. And I think you had got cut off at the time, but I was sharing with the listeners that, you know, sometimes I don't even know how deep people's stories go when I have them on. Like, I know there's certain things about them that I want to talk about or that I want to, you know, have them share.
Right.
But invariably, the stories just are like, wow. You know, you have a very, very mind-blowing story, and you're definitely a role model and, you know, someone that, you know, especially for women, I think sometimes we need that somebody where we can be like, you know what, she's just a real person. And sometimes we, you know, you go on social media and like everybody's fake and they got filters and they're doing all this
da-da-da-da-da. Right.
And then I see Sabrina pop up with her little green home gym that she done pimped out. Doing just dope stuff and positive messages. So personally, I thank you. It's definitely a breath of fresh air when I see those.
Well, my pleasure. I truly believe that I found my purpose. And this is, you know, they say whatever you are willing to do for free is probably what you're meant to do for the rest of your life. Now, I have manifested great income. I'm going to be paid greatly. It's already done. However, I love what I do. I love uplifting people. And I'm still healing. I'm still uplifting myself and encouraging myself while I'm doing it for others. So I wouldn't trade it for the world. And also, both of my books are also available on Amazon, My Spiritual Smile and Your Mind is Magic, because it is.
All right, awesome. Thank you so much. So, guys, that's our show for tonight. Thank you again to our guest tonight, Ms. Sabrina Fisher-Reese. You can find her on all the social media platforms, hashtag 59 in 59 seconds. And her information will be posted along with the replay on the website at 9seconds.org/2022episodes. So you can see all of the, listen to all of the episodes from all year long. So again, that's our show for tonight. As a reminder, if you have a story that you'd like to share, some knowledge you want to drop, or even just a show idea, something that you want to have me find guests for and to talk about, you can visit my website, marcybatiste.com/V2V, or you can go to 9seconds.org/V2V, and there's forms on both websites. And every week I say that survival is a responsibility, but so is success. So sustainable life change is well within your reach. And if you have questions about how to make some proactive changes, feel free to reach out to me on any of my social media platforms, Dr. Marcy Batiste, or online at marcybatiste.com. You can hit up Sabrina. I love her stuff. She's super motivational. She's fun to watch. So I encourage you to connect with her as well. But in the meantime and in between time, guys, this is Dr. Marcy, my guest tonight, Ms. Sabrina Fisher-Reese, and we wish you all health. Absolutely. Thank you so much. And we're wishing everybody health, safety, and success until we link up again next week here on the V2V podcast. Good night, everybody.